Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 14th of January. This hour of the program, we'll talk about prairie grasses using moderate amounts of fertilizer on marginal land, having the ability to produce significant amounts of ethanol. There was a five-year study done of switchgrass by the University of Nebraska and the USDA's Agricultural Research Service, published last week by the National Academy of Sciences, and it holds great promise for cellulosic ethanol. It, of course, is something that we're looking at even more seriously right now with the price of oil reaching $100 a barrel and prices for the agricultural commodities that traditional biofuels are made from soaring to historic levels in recent months. And the price of corn, of course, the traditional U.S. feedstock for ethanol, hitting an 11-year high. So cellulosic ethanol, this fuel that can be made from grasses and wood pulp, holds great promise, although it may not be with us as soon as some would like. We're going to be talking about this study and about the use of switchgrass. And our guest is Professor David Bransby. Professor Bransby does research in energy and fiber crops and their associated industries and forage livestock work. His research on energy crops has focused on switchgrass, but it's being expanded right now to include a wider range of both annual and perennial species with a focus on co-firing them with coal to produce electricity. Some research is being conducted with giant reed, as well as pulp and paper, and he works with producers and producer groups on applying research results from the forage livestock work and the energy crop research. He has briefed the president a couple times on the emerging cellulosic biofuels industry. He is a professor at Auburn University, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. As we always do, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. Professor Bransby, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. It's very much a pleasure for me to be on the program.
Well, the time has come from ethanol produced from these other things, right?
There's no question about it. I've been involved with research in this field, especially on switchgrass, for some 20 years now.
Oh, my.
Things have been crawling along, really not doing much, until about 2 years ago when President Bush mentioned switchgrass in his State of the Union address in January 2006, and since that, everything exploded.
Mm-hmm. Why have things been crawling around for 20 years?
Well, you know, it was actually the initial work on biomass crops to produce cellulosic biofuels started way back in 1978, at least that in the United States. It was started with woody crops by Oak Ridge National Lab in response to the price hikes, the oil price hikes in the late 70s. And of course, as all of the older people know, the price went up, the oil price went up, and then came down again. And so there was little interest in it from sort of the mid-80s through until just very recently.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, there's been this little bit of research going on all over the country, actually, and focused primarily on switchgrass for agriculture and hybrid poplar for forestry.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've collected a lot of information on those two species as potential woody crops or herbaceous crops, and we know a lot about how to produce them and what they can do. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there's not more work to be done. But nevertheless, we know how to grow those plants pretty well all over where they are adapted. What we've been waiting for is a technology that can convert them economically into biofuels. And we're not quite there yet, but I think we are very, very close, and in fact, substantially closer than I think most people realize.
Mm. Is it a difficult technology to switch them into biofuels?
That's a very complex question. There are a lot of technologies out there that can do it. That can do it technically, and of course, technically and economically viably are two different things in many cases. There are several groups of technologies. One of them is very similar to the one that is used to produce ethanol from corn. It involves enzymes initially to break the raw material down into sugars and then fermentation after that to produce ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way of doing things. You didn't mention that when we started talking that I'm probably because you didn't know, but I'm an immigrant from South Africa.
No, I didn't know that.
South Africa has got a company down there called Sasol that has produced gasoline from coal commercially since I was a kid, over 40 years. And what I'm coming to is that technology involves a process that they call gasification of the raw material on the front end and then catalytic conversion of the resultant gases to fuels. In that case, it's coal to gasoline. And if they can do it with coal, they can also do it with biomass. And there are several companies in this country right now modifying that technology to produce ethanol from biomass, such as switchgrass. One of them is called Range Fuels. That's a company, and they are modifying the Sasol process to do that. And they're pretty close to going commercial. In fact, they just broke ground here in Georgia on their first commercial plant. They broke ground on November 6th, and they're planning not to process switchgrass to start with. They are going to process pine trees, pine chips, into ethanol. Of course, if they can do it with pine chips, they can also do it with switchgrass.
Right.
There's a lot going on, and I believe progress is occurring much faster than most people think.
And Professor Bransby, it's my understanding, and tell me about the scope of this, that switchgrass can be grown on land that isn't very terrific. Can it be grown in a substantial portion of the country as well?
It is native east of the Rockies. And so it can be grown on an extremely wide range of land in a very large proportion of the country. And it north-south, it's native from the Gulf states all the way into Canada. So it has a huge range. Of course, different genetic lines are best suited to different latitudes mainly. But it can be grown across a very, very large area of the country. And also, it can be grown on poor land that couldn't support food or feed crops.
Mm-hmm.
So that is good, that it doesn't necessarily have to compete with food and feed crops for land. Having said that, I believe that there's a possibility it may still, given what the oil price is doing. And I could elaborate on that if you're interested.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Well, there are about 2.5 barrels of oil energy equivalent in a ton of biomass, such as switchgrass or wood, or whatever. So if you take, let's take a price of $40 per barrel of oil, that would make a ton of biomass worth about $100. I don't know whether you can follow that, but two and a half barrels of oil in a ton would make it $100 versus $40 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can get biomass right now at around about $50 a ton, so half of that. At $100 a ton, farmers would get rich. Farmers and forest landowners. Now I'm talking about just $40 a barrel equivalent. We more than double that now. In terms of the price of oil, the price of oil has been fluctuating between $90 and $100 for the last 2 months. At that price, the equivalent price for biomass is over $200 a ton. Now, I mentioned this to the president when I talked with him, and he asked me. He said, "Do you think this is economically feasible? This whole concept of cellulosic biofuels?" And I said, absolutely. And these were the numbers that I gave him. And he said, well, that makes sense. But he said, can we convert biomass to liquid fuels as efficiently as we can convert oil? And I said, not just yet. But I said, I don't think we're very far away. And I said, we may be doing this before you leave office, which is the end of this year.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, now tell me, there are requirements, aren't there, from the energy bill that was passed by Congress that ethanol made from switchgrass and wood chip, 2/3 of the nation's ethanol is supposed to come from non-corn sources? They must have faith in the technology.
Well, they obviously, excuse me, are very optimistic about it, and I think that there's been a lot of work done to suggest that this is entirely feasible.
Mm.
The Department of Energy has looked very carefully at it, and again, in my discussions with the president, he was the last time I was requested to participate in a briefing with him was about a year ago in the White House. And the point of that briefing was that he had announced this 20 and 10 plan of the administration, 20% reduction in gasoline use within 10 years, and he had several questions. He said, "I suspect it might have been criticism that that's not feasible." My response, and so there were about 9 of us that were requested to come into the White House and give him our independent opinions on this. And the point I made was that there's enough biomass out there to do that now, without even trying to grow anything. We can use crop residues and wood and all of that kind of stuff. We've got enough to do it. What we don't have is a conversion technology that's up and running yet. But I feel like we are very, very close, and so I think 20 and 10 is very, very feasible. It can be done. We obviously have to focus on doing it. But all of those projections and expectations reflected in the energy bill, they are entirely reasonable.
We are going to go to phone calls. Our lines are getting crowded here. 800-486-8655. And let's start our calls, Professor Bransby, with Mike from Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I got a comment and a question. The comment I have is that hopefully the guest can speak to, when he says new technology, that this is primarily a bioengineering technology, as I understand it. There's many different approaches that are out there on the table, but for the most part, it's primarily a biological exercise that, in fact, when a lot of the critics talk about the use of corn for ethanol, that in two parts is establishing an infrastructure which could be adapted to be used with cellulosic ethanol if they use a fermentation type of technique with cellulose. But my question is could the professor speak to cogeneration, siting plants to do the ethanol conversion with coal-fired and nuclear and gas-fired power plants, such that the many, literally kajillions of quadrillions of waste BTUs that are being expended to the atmosphere or to our nation's waterways could be used, or should they be used, to provide some of the thermal needs for this future technology?
Yes, I'm not an engineer, but certainly that there's no question that that is an option that needs to be looked at very carefully. Of course, it is important. Every one of these situations is going to be site-specific, and so it's going to depend on whether you have the supply of raw material around a site where you already have a power plant, which in many cases you do. I don't know of any study that really has looked at that. It's an obvious one to investigate carefully, because running those plants, you've hit the nail on the head. You know, one of the biggest costs of running a corn to ethanol plant is the natural gas that's required to provide the heat for distillation. And so it would make sense to try and pick up some free waste heat from those plants and use it for that purpose. At this point, not even the corn to ethanol plants have really looked at that.
Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Dick next from Oconomowoc. Hi, Dick.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Hello.
Initially a question, and then a sort of a follow-up political question as well. As to current corn ethanol production technology, Professor, what portion of the corn plant is used? I'm assuming it's the ear, the kernel, but all of us, I'm sure, would like to know, and probably most don't.
Yes, at this point, it's just the grain. The grain that's being used, yeah, the kernel.
The corn grain, okay. Follow-up question is, as you're aware, there's been a lot of political opposition, surprisingly, to corn ethanol production. And I was wondering if you perceive a bunch of opposition to corn ethanol production to be politically generated, and also, do you think there's a large or significant political component in the support for switchgrass biomass use?
The political opposition to use of corn for ethanol is coming, I would imagine, primarily from the animal producing sector of agriculture, because the ethanol production is at least partly responsible for the increased price of corn grain, and of course we feed a lot of corn to cattle, to hogs, and to poultry, to chickens, and so the increased price is really hurting those sectors, the profitability in those sectors. Down here in Alabama, we produce an enormous number of broilers, and our broiler producers are hurting because of that higher corn price. So I think the political resistance to continuing to expand corn to ethanol production is coming largely from that sector, which is reasonable because ultimately, you know, it's going to hurt the consumer. So now, coming back to whether political support is responsible for the elevation of at least the perception of switchgrass as a raw material, that's hard to figure. There's no question in my mind that the fact that the president mentioned switchgrass in his State of the Union address in 2006 drew an enormous amount of attention. Most people didn't know what switchgrass was until then, and a remarkable number of people know now. And of course, you can. Everybody ran to Google and Googled switchgrass after that, and that's how NPR, national NPR, found me, and I was interviewed the very next day. But so I don't know how you define what political support is, but I believe that the concept of using perennial grasses. I think there are a lot of environmental advocacy groups that are trying to support the concept of using perennial grasses on agricultural land to produce fuels, because there are just so many environmental advantages. And now those political advocacy groups, of course, are very strong politically too, and so there's no question that there is some political influence there. But I think it's all, you know, it's all actually, fortunately, based on pretty sound science.
Well, thanks for your observations.
Thanks, Dick, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. We're talking about cellulosic ethanol this hour of our program with Professor David Bransby. He's at Auburn University, and he has been working in the area of switchgrass for some 20 years, he says. Energy and fiber crops and their associated industries, all part of his research activity. His research on energy crops has focused on switchgrass, but it's now being expanded to annual and perennial species with the idea of co-firing them with coal to produce electricity. 800-486-8655, or if you'd like to send us an email, you could do that. And that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to, let's do an email here for Dr. Bransby. And it goes like this. I've noticed that the ethanol-producing plants are always venting steam as a byproduct of ethanol production. I've wondered if it's possible they could also be powering electrical generators with a steam byproduct. Is this feasible? Mike from Whitewater.
This is a possibility, but I don't think the volume of steam, generated from these ethanol plants would amount to a large proportion of a large amount of electricity. So, yeah, theoretically it's possible. Whether it's economically viable, I wouldn't know. And I'm not aware of any studies that have really looked at that too. But I think, you know, all of these questions that are looking at energy that's being wasted out of so-called energy plants are very, very relevant and pertinent and should be investigated further.
We go next to Jerry from Green Bay. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Kathleen, Professor, great show. I'm not real familiar with switchgrass, but I heard Kathleen mention giant reed, which is also Phragmites, and I am familiar with that. I had to extradite some around a pond years back, and I know how tough it is and how big it grows and how wild it can grow without any fertilizers or chemicals. I was wondering what has been done on that, the study of the giant reed.
Yeah, this is one of the problems with common names like giant reed. The giant reed that I'm talking about is not Phragmites. It's actually Rhododonax.
Oh.
And they often get confused. Phragmites grows in water, whereas needs aerated soil, but often will be growing near water, and they're very similar otherwise. Having said that, I think, you know, you're hinting at the possibility of a plant like that becoming invasive, and there's no question about it that in certain environments, in certain conditions, the giant reed is invasive, and we've got to be very, very careful not to let plants like that get out of hand. I believe that can be managed. At this point, even though I've done a lot of research with giant reed, it's a remarkable plant. It produces enormous amounts of biomass with very, very little, if any, fertilizer. We've got plots here down here in Alabama that we haven't fertilized at all in 4 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And they still are giving us between 15 and 20 tons, dry tons of biomass per acre per year, which is double what you get from switchgrass. So we're studying it from a basic science point of view at this point. I would be a little nervous about recommending it for planting on thousands of acres because we're still not 100% sure how and if we can contain it, and we don't want it to get away like kudzu has in the south.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly a candidate that we're looking at. I would say we're a long way off from recommending it as a crop. And yet there are some companies that are working with it. We feel like they can do it pretty soon. One of course, the problems with that plant is that it doesn't produce viable seed, and maybe that's a good thing, because if it did, it would cover us up in no time. So it's more like sugarcane. You have to plant it with vegetative material like stalks in the ground or with tissue culture procedures, which is probably right now the main barrier to expanding it. It's costly to get into the ground, but once it's there, it gives you enormous amounts of biomass at very low cost.
Well, thanks for all your work, Professor. I saw your little video on the internet, and looks pretty remarkable.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry. Thank you for the call. Rich is next from Boscobel. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. I have an observation that most of this marginal land that the professor speaks of that should be used for switchgrass production is currently being used quite sustainably to pasture cattle. And the idea that we're going to gain anything without increasing food costs or it's just ridiculous.
Well, I'm not sure that I would entirely agree with that. I think we have to manage the balance between energy and food crops. I believe that there's some debate about whether we can use some of the CRP, Conservation Reserve Program land, for energy crop production, such as planting to switchgrass. Now, switchgrass is already a species that is recommended to be planted on CRP land. There's no cattle cattle are prohibited on CRP land, and we have 35 million acres of CRP land in the United States. Now, I'm not for a minute suggesting that all of that can go into switchgrass, but we could use probably some of that with some modification of that program. And again, I'm not suggesting at all that that switchgrass is the only source of biomass for renewable fuel production. For example, we could use cover crops. I did some calculations just 2 weeks ago. Cover crops can be used but aren't used enough to protect the soil in between our traditional crops. So, for example, down here in the south, we grow cotton in the summer, and what we should be doing is we should be covering that soil where we grow the cotton, covering that acreage up with a cover crop such as winter wheat or ryegrass or rye or something like that, just to protect the soil, because we get heavy rain down here in the wintertime. Many growers are not doing that just because they don't get any return on that cover crop. Now, we could plant these cover crops and use them, at least some of the material produced, for energy. And I did a calculation to show that if we did this on a national scale, just a proportion of, we've got something like 300 million acres in annual crops in the United States. If you did cover crop production on half of that, and only got 3 tons per acre, you would produce an enormous amount of biomass without needing not one extra acre of land to what's being used, without competing with any food crops. So there are strategies that we can develop in the United States that will not compete with food and feed crops. We just haven't got there yet. There's been no incentive, but with $100 an oil, a barrel oil, there's an incentive now, and there's no question that it's driving all kinds of people who up until now have not been interested to be interested, mm-hmm. including every last one of the oil companies.
Anything else, Rich?
Well, yeah. Currently, you know, the stover from corn, and actually the real purpose of a cover crop, in addition to preserving your soil over the winter months, is also to be plowed down to enrich the soil, and anything you take off the soil has to be made up for in purchased fertilizer, which many times is derived from petroleum products. So I've really questioned the validity of this whole line of research.
Well, the only way we're going to answer that question is actually to do research, and research on all of this is actually in progress now. I've just thrown out some general thoughts and general principles here that we need to look at. I don't believe, and in fact, the research that's been conducted so far indicates that we do not need to plow all the cover crops from real high biomass producing crops. We would not need to plow all that material back into the soil to achieve what we need to achieve on the traditional crops, but that is true some of the inputs are going to be petroleum produced products. Fertilizer, of course, is produced nitrogen. Needs a lot of natural gas. But I believe that if you're using them to produce more biofuels than they are consuming fossil fuels, then we're ahead of the game. And I'm not saying that we have the answers yet, but we're moving as fast as we can. And I say we, universities and the government, DOE, the USDA, are moving as fast as we can to collect the data that we need to do complete life cycle analysis, which we will do. And even an enormous number of private companies are getting involved in all aspects of this as well.
Thanks very much for the call. It must be a little bit upsetting to you as a guy who's worked in this area for 20 years to see all of a sudden, because of $100 a barrel oil, it's happening now. We don't seem to have much foresight. Professor Bransby.
Yes, sir. This $100 a barrel oil has changed the whole picture. Mm-hmm. You know, coming back, and I hate to keep coming back to talking about President Bush, but here is somebody who's considered a conservative Republican president who is strongly hooked into the oil industry. He came out just about 2 years ago, and he said, America's addicted to oil. Now, a lot of people had various views of that comment, but as I see it, that was an enormous statement from a president who's been supported by the oil industry.
Mm-hmm.
And you know he took flak for that. anyway, what I'm coming to is that even the oil companies are getting involved. I visited ConocoPhillips, for example, over in Oklahoma, their headquarters, last August, and I was asked to give a seminar over there. They had hired something like 12 new engineers they are busy developing a biofuels group,
mm-hmm.
to look at how to convert biomass to liquid fuels. And here I want to emphasize that ethanol is not the only biofuel that you can produce. You can produce gasoline and regular diesel from biomass, and the oil companies know how to do that from oil, and I don't believe it'll take them very long to learn how to do it from from biomass. What they need help with is they're not used to dealing with farmers, and so they're not, they are a little nervous about the supply of the reliability of the supply of their raw material. They're used to having oil come into their facilities from overseas on a ship or coming out of a hole in the ground here in the United States. They're not used to dealing with farmers, and I think that's where, you know, those of us in agriculture can help. But again, what's happened up until now is that the biofuel sector and the petroleum sector or fossil fuel sector have viewed each other as in competition with one another, as competitors, and finally the two are starting to merge and starting to work together, and this is really good because the oil companies, well, like I said, the oil, they look at biomass and they see you can get as much biomass down here in the southeast, mainly wood, for $50 a ton. That's equivalent to $20 a barrel of oil, and they're paying $100.
Yeah.
Close to 100. Of course they're going to be interested now in this alternative raw material that is only one-fifth of the price of the one that they're using. And let me just explain, too. I've talked about two different general technologies. The one is what they call the sugar platform, where involving enzyme hydrolysis and fermentation, similar to what we do with corn. The other one is a thermochemical platform where you have gasification and then catalytic conversion to ethanol. There is a third type, which is catalytic all the way through. It's catalytic cracking in on the front end of the raw material, and then catalytic synthesis into all kinds of different fuels, including the ones that we use today that are generated from oil, such as gasoline, aviation fuel, and diesel. And the oil companies know how to do that. They do it right now with oil. And I don't believe that they would take very long to figure out how to do it using biomass as a raw material. What they don't know a whole lot about is just how to handle biomass on the front end. It is a very, very different raw material. It is bulky and totally different to oil. And so that's where they're going to have to spend a lot of time looking at it. But I believe that within the next 5 years, you're going to see technologies emerging and maybe even being commercial to produce our regular fuels, gasoline and diesel, instead of ethanol.
Yeah. Along those lines, let's go to Ken, who may have a question that will amplify this. Ken from Albany, hi.
Hello. I just want to add to that statement that we are addicted to oil because we are being a little irrational about this, in that first of all, we've got to have cars that are able to use these alternative fuels, and that's what the war on terrorism is all about, because the war is being paid for by oil profits, and as soon as we get off of the Middle Eastern oil, the war is won, because they're not able to finance the war, and that's what war is all about, money. You know, who has the most money wins.
Professor Bransby.
I think that's a very important point. My feeling is that we can get off Middle Eastern oil. And by the way, the United States, we only import 15% of the total that we use comes from the Middle East. That's much less than most people realize, and it's not very much. Just because the Middle East has most of the world's oil, a large proportion of the world's oil, a lot of people think that we import more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
We import only 15% of what we use from the Middle East. Anyway, having said that, I think what's important is that, yeah, we need to wean ourselves off that as fast as we can. My feeling is ethanol is still not the best way to go. Ethanol the corn to ethanol industry has made an excellent start to moving us away from fuels produced from oil. But ethanol has some limitations or some difficulties. As you pointed out, we need special E85 cars. We only have 6 million of those on the road today in a national fleet of, I believe, around about 200 million cars. So only 3% of our cars are E85. Ethanol only has two-thirds of the energy content of gasoline, so you only get two-thirds of the mileage per gallon. And therefore, if you're paying equal price for ethanol and gasoline per gallon, you're paying more per unit energy or more per mile for the ethanol. And then, of course, we can't transport ethanol by pipeline because it's corrosive and it attracts water. And so we got to haul it either by truck or by rail, and our rail system is stretched to the limit right now. So we've got a bunch of limitations with ethanol. If we can switch and produce our regular fuels that we use today from biomass, which I believe we can. There's a lot of work in the pipeline right now, and we will be able to do it commercially soon. We will be better off than using ethanol. Now, ethanol is still going to be needed in the quantities that we're producing today because it's required as an octane enhancer, and that's what it's being used primarily for right now. There's not large volumes going to the E85 market, but with the banning of MTBE, which is a fossil fuel based octane enhancer that is very, very polluting, with the banning of that, ethanol is the substitute, and that's where the big market is. So we'll still producing diesel and gasoline from biomass from here on out will not hurt the existing ethanol market.
Thanks, Ken, so much for the call. We'll take more in a moment. Our guest is Professor David Bransby, and we're talking about cellulose ethanol produced from grass, and he has been working on switchgrass for a long, long time, some 20 years. And we're talking about, you know, with oil reaching $100 a barrel, this interest in alternatives to oil is huge right now and may push things along a little faster. 20 years working on this and not seeing much development, it has to be frustrating, but now things are starting to happen. So we have one line open, 800-486-8655, and we'll get to as many emails as we can as well in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone call. Oh, no, let's take a couple emails, or at least one right now, for Professor David Bransby. Was wondering about the net energy yield of switchgrass ethanol. Corn ethanol produces about one-third more energy than it uses to produce. How does switchgrass ethanol compare? And have you looked into production of biodiesel from algae? This reportedly produces a much higher net energy yield. Professor Bransby?
Those are very important questions, which are, I guess, raised often, and there are a lot of different things to think about here, Kathleen. I think you mentioned that this particular program today was inspired partly by the National Science Foundation Academy of Science, a big publication of the work out of Lincoln, Nebraska on switchgrass. Now, that particular study showed that five times more energy is produced than is consumed in producing cellulosic ethanol from switchgrass. Now, that's interesting. So it's 500% more produced. So it's very, very energy positive. Having said that, the yields of switchgrass up in the Great Plains, where that study was done, are way lower than what we get down here in the Southeast. And so we would be down here, up there you get sort of around about 4 or 5 tons per acre. Down here we get 7 and 8 tons per acre. So it would be even more positive down here in the Southeast. So that's the answer to that question in terms of what's the energy balance. Extremely positive, much, much more so than corn to ethanol. Now, the reasons for that, of course, is that we use the whole plant when we use switchgrass, whereas with corn we only use the kernels, which is only half the plant. Now, having said that, I get asked this question over and over again by journalists, and my response often is to those journalists, before I even answer the question, tell me what the energy balance is for gasoline from oil. Do you know what that is? And mostly they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? It's negative. You get 0.8 units out in a gallon of gasoline for every unit in. And people say, well, how can that be? And the reason for that is that oil refining takes an enormous amount of heat, and that heat is provided by natural gas.
Yeah.
And there's so much natural gas that goes into oil refining is that the energy balance for gasoline is negative. So corn is even better than gasoline. And most people don't know that.
No, they don't. Thanks for the email, and that came from John in Fond du Lac. We go next to Renelle from Luxembourg. Hi, Renelle.
Hi.
Hi.
There's an ethanol plant that's about to open later this month in Wisconsin, in Luxembourg, and they use whey permeate as a byproduct. It's a whey plant currently already operating as a whey plant. They produce a feed product from the leftover whey. I was wondering what his thoughts are on. I haven't found anything negative about it, but the possibility of they are using it to produce ethanol from whey, and in Wisconsin as a dairy industry, I would think it would be huge for our state.
Yes, in fact, I believe that there is a there's a dairy in California that is already doing this and commercially, and it's one of the small plants that is producing ethanol with. That doesn't have corn as a raw material, and apparently it's very cost effective. I'm not an expert in that whole area, but whey apparently is a very good raw material, and often is a headache to dispose of otherwise. And so this is an excellent example of where a problem byproduct or waste product can be used, and if you get into a lot of different industries, you'll find that there's all kinds of similar situations. For example, we here at Auburn University are doing some research on using paper mill sludge. Paper mill sludge is an absolute headache at paper mills all over the world, for that matter, to get rid of, and doesn't have much commercial value, and yet the initial research looks like it's an excellent raw material for ethanol production. And it's for free, and sometimes it's actually got a negative cost because it's costs to dispose of it. And so I believe that there are all sorts of opportunities like this that can be used to our advantage.
Yeah. Is there anything bad about the smell from plants like this? That's the only other thing. Do they produce a bad smell or anything, or how is that?
I think it varies by plant, but if the regulatory people are on top of everything, it should not. Well, you know, you probably know as well as I do, whey doesn't smell good, you know, whey on its own. So I don't know what they're doing with the whey now, but I would say it is probably a pretty bad smell from that whey already, and processing it into something like ethanol should improve that situation. It may not eliminate it, but it should improve it substantially.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Renelle. Thanks
very
much for your call. Another email. The greatest challenge I see, this person says, is the logistics of harvesting, storing, and transporting it. Farmers don't like to make hay. It's bulky, more expensive to truck. Here in western Wisconsin, it costs $40 to $50 a ton to harvest it, and it needs nitrogen to yield well. Researchers at Ohio State found that 100 units of nitrogen were optimal. Switchgrass will have to compete with corn and other crops in terms of returns per acre. They've told me that alfalfa may be a better alternative in western Wisconsin from a yield and input cost. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, there's a lot of information in that comment and question. My thoughts are that clearly, unless it's economically I guess, attractive to the farmers, nothing's going to happen. Alfalfa seems to me is a pretty expensive crop. Yeah, it doesn't need nitrogen because it's a legume, but it needs very high levels of P and K, phosphorus and potassium. It depends entirely on the yield and costs and everything. It's very difficult to tell exactly how this industry is going to emerge with respect to, for example, its structure. Are we going to have large centralized plants which, to certain extent is what we have with corn to ethanol now, and a lot of growers providing the raw material to those large centralized plants, or are we going to have much smaller plants, well distributed, and maybe even being able to be owned by maybe one farmer or just a group of farmers, a small group of farmers? I favor relatively small plants, and if we have relatively small plants, then we don't. One of the advantages of that is that we don't have to haul the material that far. But there's no question you've hit on one of the issues here that's going to have to be examined and dealt with, and that is that biomass, such as switchgrass, hay, any type of material like that, is low in bulk density. You can't get a whole lot on a truck, and so transport costs are going to be high per ton, and that needs to be dealt with. Now, small plants, well distributed, favor dealing with that problem compared to large plants, but there are still ways to handle it for larger plants. Again, it's a lot of speculation as to exactly how this industry is going to develop, and I think it's all going to be what happens at any one place is going to be site-specific. I agree that switchgrass is not the only pebble on the beach out there. There's all kinds of different crops that can be used, and I think I've hinted at that already, including annuals.
Right. Yes.
Including annuals, cover crops that can be rotated with our traditional crops. Think of, you know, we talked a little bit about cover crops, Kathleen, and I mentioned, you know, growing a crop in the winter in rotation with a traditional summer crop like cotton in the south, or maybe corn and soybeans in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got 40 million acres of winter wheat. What about growing a summer cover crop such as sorghum? Very high-producing sorghums around these days, in rotation with winter wheat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's something that we could look at very seriously, too. So there's so many different options, and they all are going to vary depending on where we are. And so I think that just one last comment.
Sure.
I'm an immigrant from South Africa. Immigrants are eternal optimists. I think most of us are. And I am disappointed in the number of people who say, a number of Americans who say, I don't think we can do this. This is America. You know, this country put people on the moon 40 years ago.
Right.
And look at the fantastic space missions that NASA is running now. Technologically, those are way more difficult than what we're talking about.
Yeah, sure. I'm with you. We can do this.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much, Rennell, for your call. Carl from Madison, hi.
Hi. Two questions. The second one you've already pretty much answered. The first question is a very valuable byproduct of processing corn can be fed to ruminants, I understand. It is very valuable. What sort of cellulosic stocks could do the same thing? And the second question is it's very expensive, as you've already said, to transport the raw materials to, and then the processed materials, the output, to the markets and whatnot. What have there been any economic models done on the amount of jobs that would be created?
I'll address the second question first. The job creation is typically for about a 20, which is a very small plant, 20 million gallon a year plant. You're looking at about 30 jobs at the plant, and probably double that when it comes to harvesting and transporting the raw material. So somewhere in the region of 50 jobs, let's just say 50 jobs for a 20 million gallon a year plant. Coming back to what's left over after processing, it depends on what technology is being used. But typically, if you're using the biological process similar to that one, that of corn, what you have left over, you can get most of the cellulose and a lot of the hemicellulose as well, cellulose, hemicellulose, but you've got lignin left over, and the idea there would be to burn the lignin to generate some of the power and heat and power that's needed in the plant. So it would all be consumed, and after that you would be left with ash. Ash has some value, some fertilizer or liming value, and so the ash would be taken and put back out onto the fields where the raw material came from. So that's pretty much what it is. But the byproducts are not as valuable as distiller's dry grain that you're talking about from corn to ethanol plant. Now, in the thermochemical process, all you're left with is ash, and so you just take the ash back out. There's very little value, really, but you just can dispose of it at no cost and with some little benefit back to the soil where you apply it.
Mm-hmm. And thanks so much for the call. Well, darn, we're out of time. There is so much interest in this topic among people listening here. It's fantastic. Join us again, please, Professor Bransby. I'll be interested to see where all of this is even a year from now.
Well, it's moving very fast, Kathleen, and I think that a lot is going to happen this year.
I think so, too. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Professor David Bransby, he's at Auburn University and has been studying switchgrass for some 20 years now. His work has gone beyond this bit, and he's looking at giant reed and mimosa for production of energy as well as pulp and paper, and working with producers and producer groups on applying the research results. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for your most informed calls and emails. We'll be with you again tomorrow, 9 to 11, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.